Good morning. 7:38 here on the Mighty 690. It's a Wednesday, so that means we get to talk with the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. And joining us, we have Holly Miner and David Strantz. How are you ladies doing today?
Doing good, thank you.
Hey, good to have you on. So, well, first, I did want to ask you, how are we looking as far as any upcoming events, that sort of thing that we have coming up? I know you're probably really busy with fairs. I mean, that's a big thing right now.
Yeah, we just finished up most of the fairs. The Crawford County Fair is going on this week, and then of course we have Interstate Fair in a couple of weeks. I think Holly has a couple events coming up that I'll let her talk about, but real quick, I wanted to mention that
I need to change the calendar over.
Tomorrow morning is the Beef Forage Field Day in Parsons. Registration starts at 8:30, and then the speakers start at 9 in the morning. They'll have several different speakers talking about pasture restoration, making those tough decisions of whether to cull the herd or not, which cows to cull. And then in the afternoon, they're going to be having tours of different studies they're doing there at the research center.
Excellent. Very good. So, Holly, any other events that you want to let us know about?
Yes, we have some food preservation classes coming up, one in Independence on August 22nd. That will be at 5:30, and it's going to be held at ICC West, the Fab Food Lab there on Main Street. And then August 24th, we will be in Fredonia at Old Iron Days 4-H building there on that site. And then on August 29th, we will be back in Independence at the Public Library.
Okay, good stuff. Now, were either of you out at the Montgomery County Fair? I saw the K-State booth and the car out there, and I was looking for one of you, but you were probably busy, you know, judging something or who knows what.
Yeah, I was at the Montgomery County Fair all week. So Katie, our 4-H agent in Montgomery County, I mean, that's her deal. Like, she's down there 24/7 with it. But then I was down there helping weigh in the market animals for the kids, check in the breeding animals as well, break classes, put in results, and whatever else needs to be done.
Sure, but good fair?
Yeah, it went, other than being really hot, it was good. It went good.
That's great. Well, we're gearing up for the Interstate Fair and Rodeo here, so cannot wait for that. It's going to be a good time. So,
yep.
Holly, we're kind of cruising on into the time where we start hearing people talking about the ridiculous excess of produce. And what better way to preserve a bit of summer than with some home canning?
That's right. We have a lot of canning things going on, and we saw some of that at the fair when the kids brought in some of their canned goods to be judged, and now is the time. People are busy with their gardens, and they're producing a lot, and it's time to start thinking about canning. And so we have several different things that we that I've been hearing in some of the canning classes that I've had, and then some of the questions that we get from people when they call in. And I'd like to just go over some of those questions with people and bring everybody up to date on some of the latest recommendations for canning your food at home.
Absolutely. So starting out, do jars need to be sterilized, or can you just take them out of the package and go to town? How does that work?
Well, we always want to wash everything that we purchase new. And then if we're using jars from previous years, we want to, as we're washing them, we want to check them for nicks or cracks or any chips out of them. Even small little hairline fractures in the glass. I have a sample jar that has one of those, and those are hard to see sometimes, but we want to check everything over for that, because anything that could cause the jar to not seal properly, or when it's heated, if it's under pressure, if there's any fractures in it, it could cause it to break, and we don't want that to happen when we're canning. So we want to make sure we're checking those things out. And then, you know, when my mom was canning, we were expected to sterilize the jars, and we don't have to sterilize jars anymore if we're processing either water bath or pressure canning for 10 minutes or more. And so some people will do jams and jellies, and a lot of those recipes only say 5 minutes. And so if we process those for 10 minutes, it doesn't hurt the jam or the jelly any, but it will allow the jars to be sterilized, so we don't have to sterilize them before we use them. And so that's one step that we can take away. It's one burner we can leave off on our stove and keep our house a little bit cooler that way.
Okay. Yeah, save you a little bit of time. It's kind of two birds with one stone on that. So
exactly.
That's good. How about the flats? Do they need to be heated?
So a lot of the flats used to be, we used to have to sterilize those and boil those as well. But the manufacturers have changed the gum residue on the flats, the rubber part of the seal. They've changed that compound. And so if we were to boil those, they would get extremely hot and be very, very pliable. And when we put them on the jars, that would squish out as we tighten the jar down, or the flat down. So we don't want to boil them anymore. We want to follow the directions that are on the outside of the box of the lid or the flat, or on, if you're buying a new box of jars and flats and ring bands, then we want to follow those directions. And most often they'll say wash in hot soapy water and set aside until ready to use.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, as far as people, you know, doing pickles, that sort of thing, I know there's an abundance of cucumbers right now. Well, is there a kind of vinegar that we should be using for different pickled products?
There are vinegars that are different on the shelf. So we want to make sure that we are using a 5% vinegar. Several years ago, manufacturers came out with a cleaning vinegar, which is only about 3% acidity level. And so that one was labeled pretty good, but now they've come out with a 4 or 4.5% vinegar, and we want to make sure that we're using that 5% vinegar, because when we are water bath canning, we want that acid level to be higher so that we can continue to water bath can. And so when we're doing pickles, we want that acidity level to be at that 5%. Anything else, and we cannot assure that those pickles are going to be safe and that it's going to keep the bacteria and the mold and the yeast cells from growing. So we want to make sure that we're using that higher acidity level vinegar.
So, yeah, take that little extra time there in the grocery store, read that label, and make sure we're getting the right one.
Yeah, if we could get the grocery stores to move wax and those cleaning vinegars over into the cleaning section and the wax over into the crafting section, we would have it made. But paraffin wax is not a way to seal our jelly jars either, and they still sell it over by the canning goods, and those really should be over in the craft aisle, because those went out probably 20 years ago. Wax was not a recommended method. So if you're still using wax, process your jars in a water bath canner, those jelly jars, 5 or 10 minutes using a tested recipe. And we want to make sure we're using those tested recipes that have been proven to be safe.
Sure. Yep. Yeah, I know you need to write a strongly worded letter. now, how about how much lemon juice should we be using for tomatoes?
Right. So we've bred the acidity level out of our tomatoes as we've grown them through the years. And so to make sure that they are still acidic enough to water bath can, and whether you're going to water bath can or pressure can them, they need to have acid added back in. And most times people will do that with lemon juice. So when we use lemon juice, we want to make sure that we are using the lemon juice that's bottled in the store, because the acidity level in that is consistent. Fresh lemons, the acidity level could vary, so we don't want to use a fresh lemon. We want to use that canned concentrate or that bottled concentrate. For a quart, we want to use 2 tablespoons. For a pint, 1 tablespoon. We could also use citric acid, and for a quart, we would use 1/2 teaspoon, and for a pint, 1/4 teaspoon. And we could use vinegar as well, although vinegar is probably going to give it a little bit different taste, and probably would not be what would recommend it. Most people use the lemon juice. Vinegar, I believe it's 5 tablespoons of vinegar for a quart jar.
Okay, and we want it to be that real actual lemon juice, not this, like, I know you can get that imitation stuff or whatever.
Yes, we want it to be the real lemon juice. Comes in the big bottle. It's usually green. That's what we want to use, because we know that the acid concentrate is correct in that, and we are using the real lemon juice.
And with all these, you know, changing guidelines, that's kind of another reason. It sounds like probably don't want to be using grandma's, you know, little ball canning guide from 1962. Probably not the best idea.
No, those are great to have for historical documents or just as an antique itself, but we want to make sure that we are using recipes that have been tested, proven to be safe, and are recent. So anything past 1994 and even past 2000 would be better. The most recent Ball Blue Book is actually brown, and it has bruschetta on the front of the page. So if you are using that particular book, that would be a great source. There's also So Easy to Preserve, which is a cookbook that we use a lot. It's put out by the University of Georgia, and it has the sixth edition, I believe, is the edition that we want to use. Editions before that have had changes to them, and some of those recipes have been removed because of their unsafeness. The National Center for Home Food Preservation is a great website to go to. It has a lot of free information on that, and it also has the USDA Guide to Home Canning on that website, which is a free downloadable PDF. So that website has a lot of really good basic information. It's got some good pictures. There's some videos on it. There's all sorts of information on that website. So if you are have been canning for quite a while and you haven't come to a canning class to learn what some of the latest recommendations are, I would highly recommend that you go and read some of those basic things again so that you're up to date with what the latest recommendations are. There's been a lot of changes in the last 30 years, and if you're still doing it the way that Grandma used to do it, using Grandma's recipe, we need to make sure that we're using a recipe that's tested to be and proven to be safe.
Sure. No, that's a great reminder. And as you know, technology continues to advance in the kitchen, kind of got to keep up with that. And speaking of which, you know, something that was not around 30 years, all these smooth stovetops.
Yeah. So smooth stovetops are something that are a concern because our canners are heavy, especially if we're doing a water bath canner. We have that canner full of water, and water weighs 8.5 pounds per gallon, so that's pretty heavy. And then by the time you get all the jars in there and the jars filled with product, if you're using quart jars, that can get pretty heavy. And so some of those glass top stoves are not thick enough to be able to withstand the weight of the canner. And then some of them have automatic shutoffs. So when you heat a burner up, if a burner gets too hot or is at a certain temperature for too long, the burner might shut off automatically, and you don't realize that until you're into the canning process. And so that would be something to check out too, because if your water in your boiling water canner ever stops boiling, then you have to start over with your time. Mm. You don't need to reseal relid everything, but you do need to start over with your time. And we also want to make sure that the burners are large enough that they heat most of the water bath canner itself on the bottom of the canner. And then, of course, we want to make sure that the canner is flat and lays flat or sits flat on top of the stove. Because if it's warped at all, then you're not going to get the heat penetration that you need into that water to get it to heat correctly. And so all of those things are important things to consider. You know, a lot of times you'll be using your stove to have your canner setting on, but you might have your jars just being held in hot water on another burner. And if you're using opposite burners, you have two burners that are cold, two burners that are hot, and that temperature difference sometimes can make your glass top stove crack. So the recommendation is to make sure that you're checking with your manufacturer and seeing what your manufacturer recommends.
Good reminder. Well, speaking of new technology, how about these new multi-cookers? Can those be used to pressure can?
Yeah, so multi-cookers are used for cooking food. They are not recommended for using to can food in. Even if they have a canning or steam canning button on the front panel. The pressure process directions haven't been developed for that kind of appliance for the canner to be being used, and it does matter. So our recommendations are to determine the stove top pressure canners, which hold four or more quart-sized jars upright. And we don't know the thermal processes and the development work that was done in order to justify canning advice that is distributed with these pressure cooker appliances. The USD does know that it is our canning processors are not recommended for use in electric pressure cookers at this time. So that thermal process work that has been done to determine how much time for pressure canners was all done on a normal cooktop stove, a normal stove with the normal old-time pressure canner. So they haven't tested that with the new pressure canners that are electric. There's been no testing done on that, so they can't recommend that. So what really matters is the time and not so much the pressure. We want to make sure that the temperature, what matters is the temperature and not the pressure. We want to make sure that the temperature gets high enough to kill that botulism bacteria, that Clostridium botulinum bacteria. And what that bacteria does is it has a heat protective spore that forms around it to protect it when it gets hot. And so the only way that that spore is killed is to heat that food up to 240 degrees or above. And that's what happens in a pressure canner. Now, we think, okay, we're going to process this food for carrots are 25 minutes. I know that because we teach that in our class. So we process carrots for 25 minutes in the pressure canner. But the processing isn't just the time that they're up to pressure in the pressure canner. It's the time that they're heated, the hot water that's put on them, if they're a hot pack or a raw pack. It's also the amount of time that it takes for that canner to get up to venting the steam, the 10 minutes of venting the steam out of the canner, and then the time that the pressure, it takes to build the pressure up. So all that is part of the processing time. So we want to make sure that that temperature is up where it needs to be. Some of those smaller canners are small and they don't, you can't really vent the air out of them. So we're not sure if they're safe to use with the pressure canning method for low acid foods.
And so that would include also like the, what about these ball automatic home canners? Are those safe for those low acid foods?
Yeah. So that does not, it does not include that. So the ball automatic home canner is for acidic foods only. It is electric, but it's not a multi-cooker. It is a dedicated canner, and it comes with its own instructions and preset canning options for specific food preparation. It has the proper thermal process development done to support the recommendations with it. And Jarden Home Brands also sells an electric boiling water canner, but it is not pressurized appliance for canning purposes, so you wouldn't be able to use it to can low-acid foods. You would want to continue to use your regular standard pressure canner, the dial gauge or the weighted gauge canners for that.
Well, and as Holly, we're getting close to our end of our time here in this segment. I did want to ask you, if people do have questions or maybe they want to get on one of those canning classes, what's the best way to get a hold of you and how can they get in and do that?
Yeah, so our Wildcat Extension District website has events listed on the right-hand side of there, and then you can click on the food preservation classes. There is a registration fee that is included in that, and you can register online, or you can give our office a call at 620-331-2690.
Excellent.
There's just a lot of stuff going on with canning, a lot of changes that have been made. And, you know, I teach these classes, and as I'm teaching, people are always asking me a lot of questions. And these are just some of the main questions that they ask, but I probably get 30 or 40 questions every night during a canning class. And there's a lot of things that have changed. And, you know, it's it I don't want people to feel bad that they're doing things in an old method or an old way using grandma's recipe, but come to a class and learn what the new recommendations are, and we want you to be safe. That's the whole reason why we do these classes, is we want that food that when it comes out of the jar to be safe to eat.
That is great. Yeah, we want to get that latest information. And Daven, what do we have coming up in your segment here in a few minutes?
I'm going to be talking again about pond weeds and algae, because with these hot days we've been having and a lot of sunshine, not a lot of wind, it creates the perfect environment for pond weeds to really take off.
Okay, well, very good. Well, Holly, thanks for all that good information. Appreciate you coming by here today. And we're going to be back here in just a couple of minutes. And I know, David, you said the hot weather is going to make those weeds grow. Well, we're going to have a lot of it here today. 103, our top temperature today for Coffeyville and the surrounding area. Right now, we're at 81 as we have news on the way. Coming up on 810 here on the Mighty 690, and we continue our chat with the folks from K-State Research and Extension's Wildcat District. We have Adavin Strantz with us once again. Good morning again, Adavin.
Good morning.
So, you know, it's hot out there, and I'm not telling anyone they don't anything they don't know, but we do have some issues, perhaps, with some pond weeds. They're liking this weather, I guess.
Yeah, like you said, and everyone knows, it's been really hot the past few days here in southeast Kansas, and we haven't had a lot of wind either, or at least at the fair where I've been for the past few days. There wasn't very much breeze in Independence. So that hot weather, not a lot of wind to move the water in ponds, and the sunny days, we haven't had very many days that have had much cloud cover. So all of this, you know, combines to make the perfect combination for pond weeds and algae to really take off and thrive in a pond. I know I've already gotten quite a few questions this summer about different weeds in ponds and a few algae concerns. But now especially is really the time to start keeping an eye on your pond. Of course, pond weeds can just take over a pond and be a nuisance and not look very pretty. Blue-green algae, if you have animals that drink from the pond, you really want to be on the lookout for that, because of course that is the toxic type of algae. As the blue-green algae dies off, it releases a toxin that is very harmful to animals and people. If animals drink water from a pond that has blue-green algae in it and that toxin present, it will definitely make them sick, and oftentimes it results in the death of the animal, because the toxin attacks their liver and their nervous system. So it acts really fast, a lot of times so fast that you won't realize that the animal is sick in time to treat them. So definitely be monitoring those ponds. If you see signs of algae and you're not sure if it's just the regular filamentous algae or green algae, as it's commonly called, or the blue-green algae, it's best to block animals off from drinking out of that pond, provide them with an alternate water source if possible, and then we can get the water in that pond tested. And of course, I'm always happy to come out and look at ponds for folks. Blue-green algae, as the name suggests, most times it's really bright to blue-green in color. Occasionally it is a brown or reddish color, but it will also look like spilled paint on the water. And if you dip a stick in it and pull that stick up, it kind of looks like the stick has paint on it, where the regular green filamentous algae is more of a mossy army green color and is stringy and has that mossy look. If you were to stick a stick in it and pull it up to take a look at it. So definitely be monitoring those ponds, and depending if you have algae or if you have a different type of weed in your pond that you're wanting to control. There's different types of herbicides that work best for controlling each type of aquatic weed.
Okay, and of course, yeah, just to know which one to use, you first got to identify it like anything else.
Right. Yeah, you definitely want to identify it. Don't, like, if you had a problem with, say, algae a couple years ago and you still have a copper sulfate based herbicide in your garage and you notice another weed is on your pond this year, maybe it's American pondweed or maybe it's duckweed. So those have a different herbicide that works best to kill them off versus the algae. So it's important to use the herbicide that will work best for the particular weed you're doing or you're dealing with, and to identify that weed so you can treat it correctly.
So when we see a lot of algae, is that necessarily the quote-unquote algae bloom, or what? When do we kind of cross that threshold when we actually have what they, you know, what they call an algae bloom?
Yeah, so typically when they call something an algae bloom, a lot of times because the algae comes on pretty fast, like this time of year. So the other thing to remember is that we've had these, you know, hot, sunny, calm days, and we've had them for, you know, kind of close to a week now. So we can start seeing those algae blooms, increase of pondweed growth now, or we might see them a week or two from now. So the algae bloom is usually in referred to the harmful blue-green algae. Because it appears fairly fast and it has that bloom effect or look on a pond or even a lake. And then when it dies off, it starts to release those toxins.
Now, can this get to a point? I know it can kind of get into a cycle where it starts actually like killing the fish in a pond and you get this whole thing started ecologically, right?
Right. Yeah. So, those algae blooms of blue-green algae, when they die off, or so actually any large quantity of aquatic weeds, when they die off, they reduce the oxygen that's available to the fish. So then that's how you get the fish dying off in the ponds. So that's why we also recommend when you're treating your pond for aquatic weeds or algae, you only want to treat a third or half of it, depending on the size of your pond, at a time. And that's to give the fish a chance to adjust to the reduced oxygen level in the pond to prevent that fish kill or the fish dying off.
Sure. And then, I mean, as far as the actual application of this, I mean, it's just something you toss out on the water. What does this actually look like, the herbicide-wise?
Each herbicide is a little bit different. So some are granular that you toss out on the water. A few are liquid. Some are granulars that you can mix. So you want to make sure to always read the label on the herbicide and follow those instructions on the label for application.
Sure. And I mean, I even know as far as, you know, human recreation and that sort of thing goes, we do have advisories that have already been issued here for Kansas. I mean, right now, closest to us, I mean, Lake Parsons is under a watch right now, I know, for blue-green algae. And then closer to Wichita and Lake Afton in Sedgwick County is in that warning. And Harvey County, East Lake, is in the warning as well as Augusta. Their Santa Fe Lake in Butler County is also in a warning. So we got several these lakes and ponds around the area that are popular recreation spots that are already in some of these warnings.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, just even from a human perspective, I mean, just like animals, you know, I'm sure the thought is, you know, people accidentally ingesting maybe some of this water.
Yes, definitely.
Is it less of a worry about like skin contact? I mean, is there any concern with that?
There is a worry about the skin contact, but the main worry is ingesting it. So that's like a couple years ago, there was a blue-green algae bloom at Big Hill Lake, and they closed it because, you know, when you're swimming or out on jet skis, having fun on the lake, you know, you're going to ingest at least a little bit of that water at some point.
Once you finally fall off, you know, if you're doing tubing or who knows what, it's going to happen.
So. Yeah, and those toxins are harmful to people as well.
Okay, well, if people have questions about this, or maybe they need some help identifying or, you know, a guide to that sort of thing, what are some resources there that Extension has and that sort of thing?
Yeah, so we have a couple publications. So we have one on general pond management. So it's a publication that covers like everything from building the pond to stocking it with fish to managing the pond. But I also have a couple publications that are specifically on blue-green algae and on aquatic weed management for the pond. And then if someone has aquatic weeds in their pond that they want identified and want to know what herbicide works best to kill and control those weeds, they can give me a call at the office. That number is 620-331-2690.
Okay, David. And one more question that I had is maybe for some of those folks who might have a smaller, maybe a little fish pond in their backyard or that sort of thing, is there anything that we should know? Is, you know, are fish pretty tolerant of these temperature changes? I know, you know, if they need to be colder, they're probably going to go deeper. But in some of these smaller ponds, they might not be able to do that. So is there anything we should know on that?
So most of the time, I would hope for folks here in Kansas that, you know, they've gotten types of fish and stocked their ponds with ones that are native to Kansas. So they should be able to handle the heat and the temperature changes pretty well, provided that there is plenty of water in that pond. So this year, after, you know, the hot, dry year we had last year, that's a concern as well for ponds, is the low water level is what can be a concern for fish.
Sure. Gotcha. Well, and of course, producers know that, I mean, the next 4 days we're dipping in up into that heat danger from that animal comfort index perspective. So it's just going to be a hot one, and make sure, you know, they got water, they got shade if possible, and don't make them do anything they don't have to, it seems like.
Yeah. You know? And if you notice your pond and you're concerned that it has blue-green algae and you want to get it tested, you can give me a call at the office and I can walk you through those steps to test it. Those water samples get sent to the veterinary diagnostic lab at K-State's campus. And if you want to send samples off, it's best to send those at the beginning of the week. That way, you know for sure they get to the lab while they're open, instead of you know, like getting there on a Friday, the end of the week. But if you do happen to notice your pond looks like it has blue-green algae and it is like on a Thursday or Friday, and you don't really have time to get a sample and make sure it gets to the lab before the weekend, there is what's called a jar test for blue-green algae. And that is, you take a sample from your pond and you put it in a glass jar, so like a canning jar, an old jelly jar, any type of glass jar, as long as it's cleaned out and has a lid. And then you take that water sample that has the algae in it, and you just set it in your fridge for 24 hours. And then after 24 hours, you look at it, and if the algae has settled at the top of the jar and made a ring around the jar, that is a good indicator that it is blue-green algae. If it stayed just separated out in the jar, then that's a pretty good indication that it's not.
Okay, well, that's a really good test to be able to know and remember. If you see it here this summer as we approach the real heat, a summer into August, that's a great reminder, Dave. And anything else we need to know, maybe for the folks who just joined us, what's the number there if they need to get a hold of you?
That number is 620-331-2690.
Okay. All righty. Well, David, I appreciate you coming on as always, and look forward to chatting again here real soon as we, gear up for the Interstate Fair and Rodeo not too far away.
Yep. Thanks for having me.
All right. That's David Strauss, a diversified ag agent here on the Mighty 690, and we will be getting started with an early bird edition of Open Line that is on the way here on KGGF. We got 82 degrees at 8:23.